back injury, so I may spend part of this talk sitting down. I'm not really sure how I'm going to do. And as Ellie said, Matt and I are going to be talking about related topics, and we're not sure if we're going to strongly disagree about one of those topics. So Matt has suggested we might start contextuality war number four today. We'll see what happens. All right, so this is a little bit of a detour from most of what we've talked about in the conference so far. And that's because we're going to now consider situations where you have both pre- and post-election. And we'll just jump right in. So you all know the Peres-Merman square. This is a variant of it for 3 qubits. And this is what we're going to use to talk about confined contextuality. So this is a proof of the BKS theorem. It's maybe one you're not very familiar with. Each of these columns multiplies to negative identity. Each row multiplies to positive identity. All of the observables appear twice in the set, in a row and in a column. And that gives you a parity violation. So this proves the BKS theorem. Now, if we take this set and we now consider a case where we actually prepare a specific state, in this case it'll be this, it'll be this state, which is just the tensor product of three, plus states in the for the x spin poly operator. And then we post-select this state, which is plus y. So the assumption when you prepare a state is, if you're assuming the non-contextual hidden variable theory, is that the state you prepare dictates what all of the hidden variables are. So you've actually got some hidden assignment to all 9 of these, you just don't know what it is yet. Now, if you know the state you prepared, and then you were just to measure in that same context, that would be this one here, you already know what the eigenvalues are going to be. I prepared this state with these three pluses here, and so those are the eigenvalues that have to belong to that hidden variable set. And I also know that the whole point of having the hidden variables is that it predicts the outcome of the measurement. So if I now make a measurement in this basis, and these are the outcomes, the assumption is that those were also the values assigned by the hidden variable. So by preparing a state and considering a particular post-selection, we already know a lot of these values that have to belong to the non-contextual hidden variable assignment. Now, let's see, go on to the next slide. So we can actually go a little bit further. If you have some contexts like these, or these actually, where only one value is left undefined, then if you want your hidden variable theory to agree with the quantum predictions, there's a forced value there. You already know what the value is going to have to be in order to satisfy the constraint that the product of these three should be negative. And so we know that this one forces this negative sign, this one forces that negative sign, and that one that negative sign. And now we see where the violation of the product rule is, right? We knew there would have to be one. If we gave a complete non-contextual value assignment, at least one of these columns or rows, the product rule would have to be violated. And while this product is plus identity, these three are all negative one. And so we know we have our violation right there. So this is the sense in which contextuality is confined. Rob?
You said we now know where the violation
is. Yeah.
So you didn't mean that literally, because I could have violated it in one of the columns.
Yes, you're right about that.
One way you could violate the product rule.
Yeah. So this is a very good point, actually. But basically, what we're going to say is that when you have these situations where there's only one that's unvalued, if you want to sort of continue to try to make your non-contextual hidden variable theory agree with quantum mechanics, that value is forced, and so that's why you end up with these three values here. It's because you have these columns here, where you only have one value unfixed. Another way to say this, which I'll come back to, is that if you have some projector or observable for which the probability according to the Aronov-Bergman-Lebowitz rule is 1, then that value needs to be the same in your hidden variable theory. And that's proved independently in a paper by Matt Liefer and Matt Pusey. So it is a bit of an assumption, actually, that you should favor these contexts instead of another one. And I'm going to come back to that point later on. But as you'll see, this actually seems to be consistent with what the data will show us, and I'll come through to that. And you can come, return to your question after. All right. So summary is that given the pre and post election, we now know where this violation occurs, or we think we do. All right. This generalizes. Let me go back and say that if you've heard of Aronov's pigeonhole effect. This is actually the set that gives you the pigeonhole effect, and I can explain exactly why that is. So if you consider each of these observables up here is a parity observable, and now say that the Z eigenstates are a pigeon is in one of two boxes, left or right, then this minus one seems to imply that pigeons 1 and 3 are not in the same box. This one seems to imply that pigeons 1 and 2 are not in the same box. And this one seems to imply that 2 and 3 are not in the same box. But if I have 3 pigeons and I stick them in 2 boxes, it would be impossible for no 2 to be in the same box. So that's the paradox. It violates a classical counting argument called the pigeonhole principle. And so what I'll come back to is that sort of, you come to that kind of paradox by assuming that this exact value assignment is ontologically real somehow during the time between pre and post selection. And this generalizes that family of proofs, give rise to the n-qubit wheel family for all odd n. So here's the same kind of proof for 5. I've spread it out into a ring to make it easier to see, but it's all just pairwise polys. So each of these spokes has Bell states as eigenstates, and by pre-selecting all plus x's, post-selecting all plus y's, forcing the final value in all the spokes, we get the same violation. And so now we have n pigeons still in 2 boxes, and the same thing. I could have 50 pigeons, and if I ask any 2 if they're in the same box, they're all going to say no, which is very paradoxical if you interpret this as being ontologically real. Okay, so now let's talk about the weak value. So given that I have a big ensemble where I've pre-selected this particular state, all plus x's, and I've post-selected the state, all plus y's, I can actually define for that ensemble this theoretical object called the weak value. So far I'm not talking about weak measurement at all, just that if I know what the pre-selection is and I know the post-selection, then I can define the weak value of every observable on that system. They're all defined independently of whether I've done a measurement or not. So for every observable, I can give it spectral decomposition. And so the weak value is defined like this. It's the inner product sandwiched with the observable divided by their norm. And if I use the spectral decomposition, I can see that this is actually just a sum of the eigenvalues of the observable times the weak values of the projectors. And so I'm only really going to focus on the projectors for the rest of this talk. If we actually do a weak measurement, there's a limit in which the measurement disturbance can be so small that we really don't disturb the system in any meaningful way. I'll come back to the weak measurement issue a little bit. Okay, so the ABL rule, which I mentioned earlier, is if you know that you start with some preselection, and then you actually were to do a strong measurement, and then after that strong measurement, you'll collapse onto some outcome. Then you do a post-selection as well and collapse onto this final state, or sorry, the one that I had here, this state, phi. Then you can use the ABL formula to tell you the probability of the outcomes of that intermediate measurement that you made, given that you've already conditioned on your pre-selection and your post-selection. And the ABL formula can be written in this nice form in terms of the weak values, which are also defined by that same pre- and post-selection. So this is just the mod squared of the weak value of whichever one projector it is I'm interested in, divided by the sum over the mod squared of all the weak values. And as we'll see, this is really handy for analyzing these PPS paradoxes, the pigeonhole being one example. So, for any complete basis, we know the sum of all the projectors is identity. That also means the sum of all the weak values is 1, because if we just apply the weak value operation on both sides of this equation, we'll get these will be the weak values, and the weak value of the identity is just 1. And so we get this rule that if I have a basis with a cardinality of 2, so just I make a measurement which only has 2 outcomes, then if I know that the weak value is 1, then the ABL probability is also 1. And this is the argument that we'll say we should always assign in our NCHVT. Sorry, I keep doing that. In our non-conditional hidden variable theory, we'll also have to assign a 1 to those projectors. So this formalizes what I was saying before, that if I have only one thing that's left unfixed, then I can express that as a measurement basis with just 2 outcomes, and then I'll get this forcing rule here. And it also applies for 0, quite obviously, right? If this is a 0 up here, then this is also a 0. Okay. So let's actually dive in and look at a paradox, one of these PPS paradoxes. This is the 3-box paradox proposed by Aronov. So now the pre-selection is this state. 1, 2, and 3 are just projections onto 3 boxes. So there's a particle. It'll be in one of the 3 boxes. And then we post-select on this state where we flip the sign here. So the particle starts in an equal superposition of the 3 boxes. It ends in an equal superposition of the 3 boxes, but a different one. And now we look at the weak values, and without going through all the math, they are 1, 1, and minus 1. And I'll just take a detour here to note that if you have a weak value of a projector that is outside the eigenvalue range of the projector, so less than 0 or greater than 1, we will call that an anomalous weak value. And part of the point of this talk is to say that anomalous weak values are connected to contextuality, and actually we'll try to use them as a witness of contextuality. And also that whenever you have any PPS paradox, you need anomalous weak values to construct the paradox. The two things are interchangeable. So let's actually see how it works in this case. So if I look at this coarse grain basis, where I've just add projectors 1 and 3 together, so now there are two outcomes. I can project onto this space or that space. And this other basis over here, where I add projectors 2 and 3 together, and I have 1 over here. Then the probability of getting out projector 2, given that I make this measurement, is 1. And you can see it because I have to add up the weak values here, 2 and 3, or sorry, 1 and 3, inside this mod squared. So this just becomes a zero term, and I get exactly the same expression that I had right here. Okay. And likewise, according to this argument for the other basis, B2, the projection onto 1 should also be 1. So now I have, if I look at the fine-grained basis, this basis down here, I can see that I'm violating the sum rule now. It's not the product rule, but the sum rule for the projectors. I have two projectors in the basis that both seem to be assigned a value 1. That violates the sum rule. And so we've confined the contextuality into that basis. We know that's where there's something violating our hidden variable theory. And so again, that you can recast any of the pre- and post-selection paradoxes that Aronov has proposed in this way, and you'll see that the paradox is literally just the place where your non-contextual hidden variable theory violates the rule, the sum rule or the product rule. That's the case for all of the pre- and post-selection paradoxes. I'm going to come back to this point, so I'm going to just say it now. I could actually go a different direction in my inferences, and this is kind of related to what Rob was saying a second ago, that after I've got this one, I'd say, okay, projector 2 is 1. I could now, instead of considering this at all, I could go directly to this basis and say if projector 2 is 1, then 1 and 3 have to be 0. And now this one being a 0 directly disagrees with this one saying it's a 1. And so depending what order I choose to fill in my non-contextual hidden variable theory, I can come to a different kind of violation. It's always going to be in the same context if I use the ABL rule. But I could be saying that there are two 1s, or I could be saying that a 1 is equal to a 0. Whichever way you like, it's still a paradox. Okay, so the quantum Cheshire cat, maybe some of you guys have heard of that. So there's a neutron interferometry experiment, which I'll explain in a minute. That's just an example of this confined contextuality in the Peres-Merman square. And this is the Peres-Merman square that you're all familiar with. So in this case, I prepare an entangled state. It's this one up here. And I post-select this product state. And without going through the details, the pre-selection fixes these values. The post-selection fixes those values. The ABL rule forces these values along the columns. And now I know where my violation is. So the confined contextuality looks exactly the same. But now let me show you how this is related to the Cheshire cat specifically. So this is actually really the four-box paradox. And we can see it for the pigeonhole as well. So let me go to the whiteboard for a second here, or to the blackboard. So the experiment that they set up is like this. It's a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And it's a neutron. So they're sending a neutron with a spin through here. And we will denote the first qubit to be the spin in the z direction. So I'll define for qubit 1, this is just the projection onto up minus the projection onto down. That's my z operator. And for qubit 2, it'll be the path degrees of freedom. So this will just be left minus right. So that's what I mean by the two qubits now. I'm going to assign them physical meaning. And now we can actually look at the weak values. So For those four states, I have these weak values, half, 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 and minus half. And let me actually characterize those. I'm just going to use a little shorthand notation here. So let's say left up, left down. These are my four eigenstates. And the weak values are like this for these projectors. Okay. So now, if I want to get to a place where I have just two outcomes for my measurement, I have to coarse grain this basis. So I can stick any two of them together and then the other two together. And in this case, if I add the negative one to any of these positive ones, I'll get a zero. And so I can get the same kind of forcing rule, which is all explained up there. But where does the paradox come in? So let's say that I want to consider the basis where I have only, or the condition that the particle is definitely on the right. So if I look at the situation where the thing is definitely on the right, in terms of the weak values, then I get a zero here. So I would say that the particle is definitely not on the right side if I wanted to interpret this weak value as telling me something about the ontology, this sum. And what about the spin? What if I look at the situation where the spin is down? Well, for the spin being down, I have that situation. So the way that Aronov has interpreted this is to say that this means the particle is definitely on the left, and this means the particle is definitely spin up. But let's see. So I'm realizing that I'm going to be missing some of these setups. There actually are three bases that are important for this. So his conclusion is basically that because the spin, because the particle is always on the left path, it's over here, its mass is over here. But its spin is always on the right path. I should have written all these out. I realize that I'm not going to remember this off the top of my head. So I'm going to skip over it. You guys can look this up yourselves in his paper. But the conclusion from following all these ABL constructions is that, or the way he considers it, going back to this, is to say that the particle definitely takes this path, its mass definitely takes the left path, but its spin definitely takes the right path, and the two have somehow become separated spatially from each other. But this is actually only one kind of way you can get to an interpretation, and it's, I don't know, if you actually construct what all of these different bases are, it's kind of an odd construction to begin with. So, as I'm going to come to later on, I really don't think this is a good ontological description of what's going on. I think that the weak values are a good ontological description of what's going on. And let me actually finish the argument for the four-box paradox here as well. So if I have this basis here, I'll conclude, or I have these three bases, and I'll then conclude that the probability that the thing is in boxes 2 or 3 is 1, it's in 1 or 3 is 1, it's in 1 or 2 is 1. If I follow the argument that it's in 2 or 3, I conclude that 1 or 4 must be 0. From this, that 1 or 2 must be, 1 and 2 must be 0. And from this, that 3 and 4 must be 0. And thus, the basis that has all 1, 2, 3, and 4 has all four zeros in it. So that's the paradox. The paradox is that the actual basis with all four of these projections has all zeros in my non-contextual hidden variable theory. So the whole thing boils down to, I have a violation of the sum rule in that context. And that's what I call the four-box paradox. It's a little bit more involved to see, because you have to combine two elements on both sides, but it's the same thing.
Sorry, if we're talking about a 4D space, and the conclusion from the first one that the rank 2 projector on 1 and 4 has value 0.
Yep.
And then the rank 2 projector on 2 and 4.
Yeah, so I'm glossing over a step. So there's actually another basis like this. It has this, and then it also has this. And this, and I'm free to consider any of these bases. And for this basis now, which has three elements, those are both zero. And then I can look at all three bases like that, and then from that I will conclude that all four of them have to be zero. Yeah. Okay. Is that clear? Hopefully, yeah. All right, so now let's talk about the actual interpretations. So in the usual language of contextuality, when you say you have a violation of one of these rules, the conclusion is this is a no-go theorem. So if you get a violation of one of these rules, you should just conclude that this hidden variable theory is wrong. It's not part of the physical ontology. And whatever the values you've assigned in that thing, they don't actually mean anything physical. So, you know, these negative signs up here don't correspond to anything physical. And these out here don't correspond to anything physical. They give you the paradox. So if you interpret them as being part of your physical ontology, you get something that's very paradoxical. But it's also inconsistent. As I kind of pointed out, it depends which way you choose to do the coloring. You can get different conclusions for what is the ontology in between. It's a 1 or a 0, you don't know. But if you take the weak values as your ontology, then you get something that's consistent. So for every observable given a pre and post selection, the weak values are defined. They're defined non-contextually, which is trivial. I mean, expectation values are also defined non-contextually. And the other reason to think they're part of the ontology is that you can measure them and introduce vanishing disturbance. And if you measure them, if you take the limit that the strength of the measurement goes all the way down to 0, as you approach that limit, the pointer that you're using to measure still encodes the weak value. In the limit that there's no measurement at all, then it doesn't. But this is kind of like arguing that when you have an electric field, you define the field using a test charge, and then you take the limit, the test charge goes to 0. It's kind of the same argument as that. So, So the weak values are exotic things. They can be negative, outside the range. They're also complex numbers, so they can have imaginary parts. They're unusual, they're exotic. But when we actually, I'm gonna go through how they're actually derived in a second, and I think it's pretty straightforward quantum mechanics. So, all right, and I mentioned this before. So we define an anomalous weak value. Historically, this is defined like this. If the real part is outside the range 0 to 1, we say it's anomalous. I'm actually going to argue that if it has an imaginary part, it's also anomalous, and I'll show you why I think that's the case a little bit later on. The reason that I'm going to say an anomalous weak value is by itself a proof of contextuality is that if I have a non-contextual hidden variable assignment, it doesn't matter if I put all zeros in the basis or three ones in the basis. It's always going to be zeros and ones. And there's no stochastic average I could take of value assignments like that that will ever say this projector is negative, or this projector is greater than one, or imaginary. If I'm just taking an average of things that are always zeros and ones, I can't get outside the range. So if I'm seeing a negative weak value, then I'm seeing a proof of contextuality. And hopefully it was clear from the examples I pointed out before that all of those PPS paradoxes depend on having a negative weak value in your list. In order to get contradictory assignments, you need to be able to have different sets of weak values that sum to 0 so that you can force different contradictions in the context. So going all the way back to here, you know, I needed this one to be negative so that I could make 4 and 3 0 or 2 and 4 0 or 1 and 4 0. And that's how I get to the contradiction. It's because I have different ways of canceling them out. So, and then this last step, I'm not going to prove it here. It's in one of the papers I had in my introductory slide. But if I have a BKS set with confined contextuality, then what actually happens is that I find relations between the projectors in the contradictory context, and the relations are always just up to a sign. So what they say is that this one has to be the same magnitude as that one, possibly with a negative sign. And so what will end up happening is that some of them will have to be positive, some will have to be negative, and some will be forced to be zero because it'll say that they're equal to both the negative and the positive when you actually work this out. And then just using the fact that these have to sum to one, you can get these values. So what ends up happening is that the relation that tells you that one of them has to be the negative of the other, if you actually go through all of the math, then it turns out that that is just saying that the value of one projector times the product of all six signs of these rows and columns, which ends up being negative here. That's what tells you you have to have a negative value. And in order for this to prove the KS theorem, it has to be the case that the product of all six of these has to be negative. Every KS set will have that property. Whatever number of IDs you have, the rows or columns, the product of all of them will end up being a negative one. And if you follow that through the derivation, that tells you that one of these has to be the negative of the other. So you know that if I have a condition with a BKS set and I have this confined contextuality, it follows automatically that I will have a negative weak value, an anomalous weak value in that set. Not every one of these paradoxes has a trivial BKS set that's known for it. I think a lot of them have been generalized, actually. Like the three-box paradox, I think there is a proper KS set that's known that contains it. Okay. Let's see, am I forgetting anything? No. All right, so now I'm actually going to do a little bit of a derivation of the weak value, so you can see how this works. So Yakir likes to talk about the weak value in terms of a pre-postselected vector, the postselected vector coming from the future. So he's talking about something with retrocausality. I'm not going to be talking about retrocausality at all. I'm going to give you the sort of formal forward in time derivation of the weak value. So we're going to use a Gaussian pointer state, and we're going to couple it to a qubit. So I have a Gaussian pointer, and I do an impulsive coupling of the form like this. So this is the momentum operator, and there's some measurement strength here. So if I do a strong measurement, this is a big thing, then the result is that my pointer, which is in some ready state to begin with, gets shifted very far apart. So let's say that I have just two eigenvalues for my qubit. And you know, now I have a pointer centered over here corresponding to the qubit being in, say, state 0, and another one centered over here corresponding to the qubit being in state 1. And now if I do a measurement of the position and I find the qubit is over here, it's dominantly going to be in the state 1. And if I do a measurement of the position of the pointer and I find it over here, then it's dominantly in the state 2. So the strength of the measurement is really just telling us how well have I separated these two Gaussians. And the overlap of the two Gaussians is actually a good measure of the strength. Or actually the 1 minus the overlap of the Gaussians. So if I go to a weak value, I'm going to do the exact same thing, or to a weak measurement, but I'm going to let this coupling strength be much smaller. And so now what will happen is that my two lambdas will be very close together, and I'll have a Gaussian centered on one and a Gaussian centered on another. And you can see that because these are overlapping now, they should interfere. But this is a weird thing because I really have a state, if I call this psi 1 and psi 2, I really have a state like this. And here's a question for you. If these are both, if psi 1 and psi 2 are both position wave functions, do they interfere right now?
Nope.
Are they interfering yet?
Nope.
No. If I project the qubit, will they then interfere?
Nope.
Okay, so that's kind of the interesting thing that happens here. So this is, I think, a really interesting question that goes beyond the scope of this talk, actually. But yeah, so let's say that I project the qubit onto some state. And I'm going to, let's see, go through all the math here. So let's say that I have this state initially. It's not just equal mix, like I said, but I have some coefficients. So that's what I actually have. And now I do a post-selection onto this state over here. So I project onto that state. Then what happens is that I do now get interference between the two Gaussians. And in the limit that this shift is very, very small, I can approximate the new interfering wave function as another Gaussian. And its shift is the weak value, which can be complex. So you can actually say there's a real shift and a phase tilt. You can bring out the imaginary part if you like, but this is still the correct form of this thing. It's a Gaussian with an imaginary shift in it. And the weak value for that case is defined right here in terms of just these coefficients that appeared in the pre-selected state and the post-selected state. So if once I've done the coupling and created this entangled state, now I project onto the qubit, and that shifts the pointer function should now be centered at the weak value, which is a complex number, so I'm not going to try to draw it here. But the point is that I had interference that was mediated by the entanglement with this other qubit. And so what I did to the qubit affected how these two things interfered. And so all of these coefficients in the pre and post selection appear in the weak value, which tells me where this pointer function is now. As a slight detour, if you guys know the delayed choice quantum eraser, it's the same thing. So the delayed choice quantum eraser, I say this is my Gaussian times a phase tilt. This is the Gaussian times the opposite phase tilt. And now, if I project onto zero, I get a Gaussian, because this will just vanish in the density. If I project onto one, I get a Gaussian, because this will vanish in the density. If I project onto an equal superposition of zero and one, I'll get e to the ikx plus e to the negative ikx, and so I'll get an interference pattern, a sine wave. And if I project onto e, you know, zero minus one, I'll get an interference pattern. So the delayed choice quantum eraser, you entangle a pointer function, which happens to be the beam profile of one of your particles, with the path degree of freedom of the other one in the original experiment. And then letting a beam splitter at the end decide which of these two measurements you make, you either get the interference pattern out or you don't. So the question again is, when did the interference actually happen? Did it happen when you did this post-selection on the qubit? Did it happen immediately? It's sort of an interesting enigmatic question. But these are both examples of interference mediated by entanglement with a qubit. Okay, I think I already kind of mentioned this. So an argument that the weak value is physical is that if I do this exact coupling, nothing strange about this, it's all one direction in time, quantum mechanics, in the limit that I let this g go to zero, so that these things just coincide, I'm always going to have the weak value encoded in the wave function. I may have to do more measurements to get it out, but nevertheless, it's always encoded into that wave function, the interfering wave function here. And so, yes, all the way in the limit, the pointer doesn't move at all. But again, I think this is really the same way that we define the electric field. We just take the limit that the test charge goes to zero, and we say the electric field is still there. This is kind of like saying that even in the limit that I don't actually do a weak measurement, all of the weak values are still there and defined, even if I haven't looked. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about how we get this contextuality witness. So if I have my set of, this is now going back to the case where I have some weak values assigned. So let's go back to the three-box paradox for a moment. So there's an anomalous weak value here, obviously, right? This one is negative. Is that the only anomalous weak value here? Is there another one? Yeah. So if I look at the projector 1 plus 2, that projector has a weak value of 2. So that's also anomalous. So it's really what you're seeing, because these have to sum to 1 no matter what, the amount of contextuality is kind of related to both how far the biggest projector goes above 1 and how far the negative ones go below. And so to construct an observable for the whole context that sort of captures all of that at once, what you do is take the projectors multiplied by these signs, where the signs are the sign of the real part of the weak value. So what I'm really going to be doing is saying, I'll take, identity, right? Minus the weak value of 1 plus 2. And then, so this has a positive sign because these are positive, and then minus a negative sign. Oh, you probably can't see that. But in any event, we're finally going to get to identity. Sorry, if I take the weak value of this thing now, I'm going to get to 1 minus 2 minus 1, and so negative 2. So this is an anomaly for the entire basis, the entire context. And notice that if each of these projectors here, if their weak values were all constrained to be between 0 and 1, then identity minus those, regardless of what these signs were, could not go below 0. So this number can only go below 0 if I have anomalous weak values. So I can if I do an experiment where I measure this witness weekly, it's an observable that you have to measure weekly to see the effect. Then I can really capture the non-classicality or the contextuality of this entire basis. Okay. This is some data. We actually did an experiment using neutron interferometry. The neutrons are all measured separately, and we can compile the data together. And I'll go and show you how that works. So you can see that if I look at the individual projectors, these all are anomalous, and we can violate the bound of zero that we should get for a non-contextual hidden variable theory by some number of standard deviations. And if we look at the actual contextuality witnesses, which use all of the projectors in each context, we get this kind of violation as well. Sorry, I need to blow my nose. And this is what the actual experiment looks like. So again, there's only one neutron in here at a time. I'll skip most of the description here. We have a guide field. This kicks out unwanted preselections. So this is fixing, these two things are fixing the preselection in the state we want, plus x for each qubit. This is a weak coupling between the path degree of freedom and the spin degree of freedom of the neutron. This is a phase shifter. For some of the settings, in order to get the weak value, we have to block one of the two arms. So this can just be shifted to block one of the two arms. And then this does the post-selection. So we only have one neutron in here at a time. And even though there are two effective qubits here, we are using the path degree of freedom as a pointer to measure to weakly measure the spin degree of freedom in this case. As a slight detour, this thing is actually not by itself an observable. It's made out of different observables. But there's an interesting thing we can do. If I take some system and then of n qubits, I measure the x measurement on all of them, but I don't care which outcome I get. Okay, I can have any outcome I want. I'll keep all of them. I'll just separate them into different bins, and then I'll do a weak coupling. And then afterwards, in the z direction, and then afterwards I'll post-select them all onto the y basis. Again, I don't care which values I get. They could be plus y or minus y individually. Going all the way back to this wheel, this wheel family is the one that I was showing you in those figures. And it works for any odd number of qubits. But notice that these signs, I chose a case where they were all plus one, right? But what if some of them had been minus and some of these had been minus? They would force different values to the outer ring, but that's still where the violation of the product rule would be. It will always be in this outer ring no matter what. And the signs that I assigned when I constructed those witnesses are going to depend on which of those it was. So these signs will now depend on which assignment I got, but I can still take the sum over all of those cases to construct a witness that uses all of them. So the reason this is here is because someone raised this question about, can you do this where you don't throw away any data at all? And the answer is yes. I can do these X measurements, keep every result. Do the Z measurement, the weak Z measurement, keep every result. Do the post-selection on Y, keep every result. And because each and every one of those gives me one of these independent witnesses, I can now sum them to get a thing that gives me the violation for all of the data in the experiment. So I don't know that actually adds anything beyond what you get for each individual pre and post-selected ensemble, but you can do this. If you're concerned about specially conditioning the data, you can actually keep all of the data and still see this violation. Okay, so this is kind of the most controversial point, I think, and I mentioned it before, but let's explain it. So the weak values are separable. If my pre-selection is a product state, which is what I said for the cases we were looking at, or most of the cases. So the wheel case, they're all plus x product states. The post-selections are also product states. They're all plus y's. And the polymatrices are always separable. If I have an n-qubit polymatrix, it's always a tensor product of single-qubit polyoperators. That means that I can actually always factor the weak value, right? The weak value just becomes the tensor product of two weak values. It's tensor product of two things that are just one-dimensional, so it's still one-dimensional. But nevertheless, I can do this, And this is an interesting prediction of quantum mechanics because, and this is actually, this would be true for any probability theory, for anything under the assumption of separability, sorry. That if I have completely separable systems, it won't matter how I do the coupling to those two systems. If they're separable, the ensemble average will be the same. So what I mean is that whether I have a pointer which couples to both qubits and does the ZZ weak measurement, or I have two pointers that couple to each of two spins separately and do individual Z weak measurements, this product has to be the same. And that's true in any generalized probability theory. But what's interesting here is that these individual ones are both I, the imaginary number. And their product is negative one. That's how you get these, all of these ZZs being minus one. So all of these pairs are minus one because all of these are minus one. So coming back over here, you know, I can do this measurement where I couple directly to sigma z up here with one pointer function, and then the mean will shift to be negative one. Or I can do two separate couplings to two separate qubits, and both of their means will shift to be I. But nevertheless, the prediction is that the product is the same. So what this lets me do is I can actually test my contextuality witness for n qubits without ever having to couple two of them. Because quantum mechanics makes this one prediction, and the non-contextual hidden variable theory makes the other one, and it doesn't matter whether or not I can actually do the coupling. I can verify that the non-contextual hidden variable theory disagrees with the predictions of quantum mechanics in this way. So the reason this works, and the novelty of it, really jumping around my slides here, is that all of these spokes, those are the coupled measurements I would have to make. If I wanted to do a full, the usual BKS test, I would just prepare some ensemble of states and randomly measure any of these contexts. And in these cases, the eigenstates on here are actually Bell states. And so I would have to couple the two qubits in order to project them onto Bell states. But if I'm only interested in the expectation values and not individual values, then it's trivial that for any average, the expectation value, the weak value, whatever, these are always going to be non-contextual assignments. And if they're non-contextual, then the IYYI that appears here in an entangled basis has to be the same one that appears here in this separable basis. So this gives me a way to do this probing without actually having to put the two together. So that's what we did here. You know, I'm saying I have 17 qubits, but there were only one at a time. All I actually did was measure. We just did the experiment 17 times, and we separated them in time to make sure that issues like flux in the reactor or drift in the reactor flux wouldn't affect the data very much. And we just collected enough data for each one to get good enough statistics. And then we stopped and did it again. And we collected all of these 17, finding that all of the z values are roughly equal to I. And then we can multiply the pairs together to get minus one. And from those, we can construct those witnesses I was talking about before. All right. So I think that's pretty much all there was about the separability, and that's pretty much all I have. So we can confine the contextuality using pre and post selection. We can witness this kind of contextuality using the anomalous weak values that appear in that context where we can find the contextuality. So, you know, to kind of recap, I can take one of two interpretations. I can say that the fact that, you know, all of my pairs of ZZ are minus one, I could interpret that ontologically and say that I have, you know, 50 pigeons, but no two are in the same box, but that's paradoxical. I really don't know what to do with that. Or I can say that the weak values of the actual projections, which are the ones that I showed before, the half, 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 and minus half, you'll always get that for that square configuration, that those are what's sort of ontologically real, because if I'm doing weak measurements, even in the limit that I don't really do a measurement, as I let the strength go all the way to zero, I'm still getting that weak value out. So that's the thing that seems to be there. If I actually physically probe what's going on between the pre and post selection, that's what I see. The values that are in the non-contextual hidden variable assignment are not what I see. In fact, as far as I know, there's no way you could physically test that those values are there. And I have a few more minutes. So the fact that we can do the separability, I think, is a really powerful tool. It means that for any Pauli observables, even if I took the case, jumping back again, for the Cheshire cat, right? So this one, my preselection was actually an entangled state. So this one doesn't have the separability condition I was talking about. But if I preselect on this column, I preselect z and x, postselect on that column. Now the conflict is forced into the entangled basis here. But to measure these weak values, I don't have to couple these two qubits. I can just measure zz because this is a product state, this is a product state. And so I can do all of them separately and get the weak value out. So in many cases, you can do the confined contextuality in such a way that you prepare and pre and post select product states, and then you can do the entire comparison using only separable bases. So I'm going to close with one more reason why I think it's not good to interpret these things ontologically. Actually, I really need the whiteboard for this. So I started by saying that I have this non-conditional hidden variable theory. Once I prepare my state, I should know that I have these eigenvalues right here in my non-conditional hidden variable theory. And the assumption is that because I measure it and got these values in the end, those should also have been in my non-conditional hidden variable theory. But there's a really weird thing going on when I actually make this assumption that I think is a little bit glossed over. So if I know that when I prepared the state, it already had this form, why is it that if I'm free to make a random choice, I could have seen this, right? I could have actually happened to look in that context, and I would have now seen this violation of the product rule manifest, you know, in my experiment. But we never see that. That doesn't happen physically. So how do we interpret that? Well, if we want to say that when I prepared the state, this value assignment exists, there are two ways we can kind of explain what we actually do see in the experiment. One is that we don't actually have full free choice, which kind of goes back to what Eric was saying, that somehow nature just forbids me from measuring this that time. That's why I never see it. That's a pretty weird interpretation. The other is even weirder. It's that once I choose my measurement, nature does some retrocausality and moves the violation somewhere I wasn't looking. Okay? And those are really the only two explanations I can see if you want to interpret this whole thing as what's ontologically there. If all nine values are there, I should be able to randomly see one, unless I should be able to randomly see the violation, unless I have a restriction on free will or nature somehow shuffles it up to hide it from me. And I think both of those are kind of ridiculous explanations. So I think that's just one more reason that you should not interpret these values as being ontologically real. You should interpret the weak values as being ontologically real. Okay, that's all I've got. Go all the way back to the end of my last slide here. Sorry if that was a little scattered.
Time for a few questions.
Is the pigeonhole principle related to Specker's scenario at all?
I'm not sure which scenario you mean, actually.
Specker described these correlations where you have three boxes, you can only open two of them at any given time.
Oh,
and,
right.
You either find a gem in the box or...
Yeah, it's been a while since I looked at that, so I just don't know the answer off the top of my head. I'm not sure. Possibly it is, yeah.
I guess just to be clear, like some of the other contextuality kind of proofs or setups, the anomalous, or your, I think you call it your contextual observer,
The contextuality witness, that observable.
Yeah. The witness, is it true that not all anomalous weak values will lead to a witness of contextuality in that sense?
No, I mean, yeah, you can use the projector itself as the witness. The one I constructed just sort of captures the effect for the whole context. Because really, all that's happening is it's confined into a specific context. It's not meaningfully confined to one projector or another. If you happen to know which projector you want to look at, then that's a witness. But the witness I constructed, the C, just allows you to look at the whole context where the violation is without having to care which particular projectors will be anomalous.
Okay. I guess I was thinking, like, in some cases, you might have an anomalous weak value that's really large, like 1,000 or something.
Yeah, that can happen.
And if you go -1,000, -999, then it would still be, like, +1.
Yeah, they have to sum to 1 by definition. So yeah, you can construct it. For that situation, what you would basically be doing is getting a witness that goes to 1,999 or 998 maybe. Yeah, and so that would give you a big violation. Yeah. Yeah, a detail I didn't mention here is that to get these really large values, you have to use a very rare pre and post selection. So you'd have to run the experiment for a long time to be able to collect data for that.
That was an experiment, right? So how is it, what are the probabilities of, you know, success here if related to the total number of results?
Well, in this case, we were not doing the thing where we get to keep all the data. In this case, if we don't satisfy the pre-selection criterion, it gets thrown away. If we don't satisfy the post-selection criterion, it gets thrown away.
So what is the percentage of what was left?
I actually don't know.
Is it an order of percent, or is it an order of?
I think that you lose half of them here and half of them here, so I think it's a quarter, roughly a quarter of the runs. Yeah. Yeah.
You said that big values come up to you, but it's confusing because sometimes it's an imaginary number.
Yeah. Remember that I'm not saying that there's an imaginary particle or something. All I am saying is that the shift of this pointer function was in the imaginary direction. That when I look at this function right here, this z week right here can be complex. And like I said, the imaginary part will just become a phase tilt in that case. But nevertheless, that is what is encoded in the pointer function. Once I've done this coupling, that's what the pointer function has. It has in it that I can read out. Yeah.
In the experiment you did that, you only did sort of one pre-selection. So you never looked at sort of like all of the six bases. It's one pre-selection, one post-selection, in between the divisions.
Yeah, and we're choosing, because it's only a single qubit, we're choosing the product pre-selection and post-selection by definition, right? Because it's only one qubit at a time that I'm doing. So I'm pre-selecting plus X, I'm post-selecting plus Y. And I'm doing a weak coupling to Z in the middle.
And is there an art to figuring out how weak the coupling
should be? In this case, the coupling was probably not as weak as it really should have been. And this is a really important detail. I'm glad you raised it. So I think in our experiment, the coupling strength was about 6%. If you look at the 1 minus the overlap of the pointer functions, in that case, they were qubit pointer functions, you could go a lot weaker. And an important detail that I glossed over is that even though the weak values are defined, whether or not I do a weak measurement in the middle, if I do a weak measurement in the middle, there's a good argument that I will have disturbed whatever hidden variable assignment I created by doing the pre-selection. So when I pre-select, the assumption is that I have some hidden variable assignment. But now if I do anything that disturbs the state, in principle, I could change all of those assignments, right? So there's another argument given by Matt Liefer and Matt Pusey, based on transformation non-contextuality, that if I have some channel that introduces a disturbance, I can always recast that channel as doing the identity map with high probability and some POVMs with some small probability. And so with large probability, I can say that the hidden variable model I have was not disturbed. So in the limit that I take the strength all the way down to zero, I can basically say that I didn't really disturb the model with any high probability at all, or with nearly no probability was it disturbed.
You take that into account in terms of your sigma calculations? So
these sigmas just come from the actual experimental fit. The way these weak measurements are done, you can't control exactly what the phase is here. So they do a scan, and then they fit that scan to a sine wave, and then extract the correct weak value that they want from the fit. Because we can't actually get exactly the right angle we would want for plus X or plus Z by tuning some knob in the experiment. We have to calibrate it that way. All right.